Welcome to new listeners. What is I Seem Fun, the Diary of Jen Car... God damn it! This is exactly what it is. I couldn't even say my own name. And I almost just hit pause so that I could edit this out. But screw it. That's what this podcast is. I Seem Fun, the Diary of Jen Kirkman podcast, is a solo podcast done by me, comedian Jen Kirkman. You may remember me from Chelsea Lately or Drunk History. You may have read my books. You may have seen my Netflix specials, I'm Gonna Die Alone and Just Keep Living. This is where I go to say whatever the hell I want. There doesn't have to be punchlines. It doesn't have to be politically pleasing to any particular group. It doesn't have to be funny. It can be sincere. I've cried on this podcast before. I've definitely been funny on this podcast before. I've been informative. I've been stupid. I've just been a human. This is where you can go to, for free, listen to a performer riff for an hour about what went on in their mind, in their world, in their life that week. I started this podcast in 2013 when I was a writer and performer on the Chelsea Lately show. Because of how fun that show was, and I was doing things like Drunk History, a lot of people thought I was a very fun party girl. And so they were coming to my shows drunk and screaming things out, and I realized this is out of control. People need to know that I seem fun, but I'm really not fun. I like to do dumb things like stay home on Friday night and make lists, and I like to not be wasted and shouting things out if I'm in the audience somewhere. I wanted a podcast for people to find the real me. And it's been one of the most fun things that I've ever done in my creative life. So if you start listening to the podcast and you feel lost and you feel like it's a conversation that you're not part of, that's kind of what it feels like. But if you stick with it, you'll start to understand that it's random and you can be part of it anytime you want. I will read you a review from the Onion AV Club. What makes I Seem Fun funny is Kirkman's inherent knack for cultivating conflict, even talking into a microphone in a room by herself. Whether she's dissecting a negative iTunes review from an angry Christian or seriously considering a class action suit against Robin Thicke for being gross, Kirkman is eternally embattled, but she tempers her cynicism with sweetness, and more often than not, she's right. Get ready to step inside to I Seem Fun, the Diary of Jen Kirkman podcast. Welcome.
I seem fun. I seem fun. The Diary of Jen Kirkman podcast.
I Seem Fun, the Diary of Jen Kirkman podcast. Who cares what number episode this is, right? Who cares? Oh, boy. Let's get all the biz out of the way. So, those of you who are on my newsletter, you would have... That's professional. You would have gotten the word that I will be in St. Louis, Kansas City, and Omaha, Nebraska, May 14th, 15th, 16th. Yes, these are weekdays. That's when it could be done, or else it couldn't be done at all. I apologize. That's when I'm coming. And tickets go on sale Friday, March 8th. So if you were not on my newsletter, why don't you get on it? Go to jenkirkman.com, click tour, it's right there, sign up. You'll get an email that morning with the links. You know, click them, you buy. Kansas City is a very small venue, so I wouldn't wait. I wouldn't wait to buy on that. That will be sold out before I get there. All right. Everybody, thanks to everyone who came to my Story Lab show last week in Los Angeles. Maybe I already thanked you. I probably did. The newest one is March 21st. That's on sale. I'm really excited about the new fun story I'll be telling. And I may have a special guest. I don't know if he's available or not. But if not, then we'll still have a good time. So the tickets are on sale again, jenkirkman.com. Click tour. March 21st, 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Improv Lab. Fun, cute, little, intimate cabaret space. Full bar. Come enjoy yourself after work. And everything else is still on sale. Dallas, I will be there this week. Two shows Friday. Two shows Saturday at Hyena's Comedy Nightclub. Selling and signing books after. Then Phoenix, March 16th, I swear to God, if I don't sell this out, I don't know why this date is a stickin' stickler. I cannot move tickets on this one. They say to me, oh, people show up the night of. That's how they do in Phoenix. I don't know. It's more Scottsdale. It's Desert Ridge. It's Copper Blues Live, Scottsdale, Desert Ridge, Phoenix area. I know. Listen, I'll be there. I'm just trying to explain it to you. Just if you live in fucking Arizona, just go. Just go. Great. That's going to be super fun. The hilarious Tony Tripoli is my opening act. Again, this is Saturday, March 16th, 7 o'clock, the night before St. Patrick's Day. If you need to do something stupid and St. Patrick's Day-ish, not that it's stupid, but people get stupid, you can do it after the show. We'll all be done by 9, peeps. And then I will be in Portland, Oregon at the only comedy club that I would one of the only comedy clubs I will play, the Helium in Portland, March 28th through 30th. 5 shows. The more you buy tickets in advance, the less I have to do press when I'm there. I have to get up at 5:30 in the morning on a Friday if the things aren't sold out in advance. So why are you fucking doing this to me? Get the goddamn tickets. JenKirkman.com. Click tour. And that's what we'll do. And everything else is on sale. Philly, Pittsburgh, Salt Lake City, Boston, Brooklyn, other things. Just go to the darn website. Oh my God, we got a Europe trip coming. Definitely London, probably back in Manchester one night. Listen, I'd love to go all the other places, Brighton, this, that, but I don't want to be gone for too long, and I want to also use this as a vacation, and I cannot be gone longer than 2 weeks. So it's just going to have to be London and Manchester. Then I might go into like Belgium or Amsterdam. Like, it's already being worked out. I am skipping Dublin. I'm sorry. I could not pull the trigger to do it. I did not enjoy myself enough last time, and I bombed, and I don't want to put myself through that again. So you know what? I was reading a lot about all different artists, and some artists who are super hugely famous, like have not even ever played certain markets. So I think, you know, I'm doing the best I can. I'd like to hit places I've never been, as I haven't had a vacation in 2 years, and I would like to go see something. So I can't really announce the other cities yet, but they have been decided. So just know that that's coming September, October, November-ish. We'll figure it out. Whew. And then, oh my God, I'll be in Birmingham, Alabama this year. I'll be in Nashville. I'll be in Richmond, Virginia. I'll be in Durham, Raleigh, Asheville, North Carolina. I forget which one of them or two of them. I will be in, hopefully back in Minneapolis. I will be in, I don't remember. Listen, I'm coming everywhere. So just sign up for that goddamn newsletter. Okay, great. Is that enough business? And of course, all my wonderful merch is available at TeePublic, which is where my merchandise store is. If you go to JenKirkman.com, click shop, you can get a Girls Will Be Girls t-shirt or a sticker, feminist as fuck pillow. I have one. I love the way it looks. Again, I seem fun t-shirts and hoodies and onesies for your baby and your friends' babies. And that leads me to, so I got an angry letter from a mom, and I wrote her back really quick, like, this is awful. You're toxic. Don't write me ever. Unsubscribe. Which isn't me at my best, but when you email the I Seem Fun account and use it for what it's not supposed to be, when you use it to malign me and to say terrible things about me and to project all your bullshit onto me, you're going to maybe not like what you get responded. That's, can I speak? You're not maybe going to like the response, because if you catch me, oh, I don't know, on an off week, such as the one I blatantly said I was having last week. So I got a letter from a mom, and it upset me on so many levels, because I am tired of us child-free people being talked to this way. It is a one-sided anger, and no one believes it, but it's the parents to us. Because we can't say fucking anything without them going crazy and without them taking it personally. I believe what set this woman off, because last week I talked about climate change. And I was trying to talk about the Sunshine Group or whatever that group was that filmed a bunch of kids going into Dianne Feinstein's office and acting like it's the Democrats' fault that we don't have more effective climate change legislation. We have Donald Trump just left the Paris Agreement. The climate issue has been a problem for decades. And it is not Dianne Feinstein's fault. And I believe the science of the Green New Deal is a little off. So anyway, I wanted to get into that without getting into it. And I had one of my, what I named the episode, unpopular opinion. It was a, it was to the left of, it was like, I don't mean left as in liberal, but it was to the left, to the right. It was off the center of what the discussion was, which was climate change. And mine was, well, if you have a young kid, then when you were getting pregnant, you knew the climate was past the tipping point, right? You chose to have that kid anyway, which is fine. Again, as I said last week, normal. Can't just stop populating the urge. And our sort of denial about how bad climate change will be or how fixable it can be is part of our hope in human spirit. You know, but that is a complex part of our hope in human spirit, is that we're in denial about this. And I don't know what to do about it either. You know, I stopped eating meat 30 years ago. If everyone stopped eating meat, would that still have made a difference? I don't fucking know. You know, I don't do everything perfectly. So it was a comment on specifically just the parents, not parents, the parents of those children who sent them to Dianne Feinstein's office. I think it's a little traumatizing. I think you're not actually teaching your kids how basic civics works, how bills are passed. Dianne had to explain that to them. And you're giving them an inflated sense of drama and ego around this issue, which it doesn't need any more of that. It needs an acceptance of how bad it is. It needs a calmness. It needs a hope. But it also needs an acceptance that this might be it. But we're going to do everything we can because it's the right thing to do. And it creates tons of new jobs. But to go in there, you ruined everything and we're saving it. That's where trauma and conflict lies. That's not where peace is. That's not good parenting. And I don't care what anyone says. I don't need to have a kid to know that, because I am someone who lives a spiritual life. Those principles apply anywhere. And when people say they can't learn anything from people that aren't parents, anyway. I didn't like those parents that sent their kids into Dianne Feinstein's office. I especially didn't like them because it's not as though they didn't have the information when they procreated that climate change will affect their children no matter what we do. Even if we fix everything today, there will still be effects that will affect their children. Now, it was a snarky way to say, don't use your kids as a pawn. And don't act like such a fucking victim. Because that's what people do when they're part of a political movement. Bernie does it and Trump does it. You guys are victims. These people are keeping us down. And it's usually weirdly on Bernie's side and other people like him. It's usually the other people on our side are keeping us down because they're not as pure as us. That's what I was talking about without directly talking about it. And I think a woman got upset with me. Now she claims that she's been upset with me for a long time. So I will read this. Kids, I'm trying to find the letter. Okay, so she starts off with compliments. I can't get enough of this. You're so great. That doesn't soften me up. Twice I unsubscribed to your, I have to just read this all the way through. It's impossible. Feels impossible for me to not stop and narrate as I go, but I just have to get it out. Twice I unsubscribed to your podcast. Both times it was a knee-jerk reaction to the way you spoke about us breeders. Ultimately, I keep coming back because there's no one like you, and I can't wait to see what you do next. I don't know. Probably I'm just sensitive, but when you talk about parenting, you say things that are just, how do I explain it? You really don't know anything about it. I mean, sure, you were a kid once, and you probably know kids and moms, but that's like me, a white chick, saying, I have black friends. It doesn't mean I understand what it's like to be black or I'm remotely qualified how to tell a person how they should behave as black. Oh my God, it's so hard not to comment. That is racist, and it's also stupid because being a kid is qualifying. And it's not the same as saying I have black friends. I'm saying I actually was a kid yet. You're so out of school with the parenting stuff. You don't know how out of school you are. I've never heard that expression, by the way. I can't not comment. Understandably, oh my God, who could possibly project the experience of at least 6,570 days of being completely responsible for the health and well-being of another human? I mean, of course you have the right to complain about the elephant-footed toddler running around on the apartment floor above you or the terrible kid in line at the airport, but maybe you could stop at actually judging anything about the situation because no one wants to hear it from someone who hasn't experienced the unrelenting joy and hell of it. Don't speak for all parents. You don't know what they fucking want to hear. Moms get judgment from all over, spelled wrong, she put it as one word, the goddamn place every day. Family, teachers, other moms, of course the kids are the worst. And we'll take it from someone with hands-on experience who knows how really fucking hard and wonderful and pointless it is to propagate the most destructive species of living garbage makers this solar system has ever known. I get it. We're ruining everything and it's too late to do anything about it. So, sorry. Parenting tips from someone in your position, which from here is a glamorous fantasy life, even if you don't experience it that way, feels like an affront. I'm listening to you specifically as a fun escape from the boring-ass cacophony of mommies telling other mommies how to do shit. I can see how it seems like breeders are fair game. Being the mainstream, they should be able to take it. I just think you're funnier when you stay in your lane, or at least recognize when you stray from it, you're an interloper. Okay. I don't care if I'm an interloper. I'm not trying to get in a lane. I'm a human fucking being on earth. And I am a cultural commenter as a comedian. I comment on what I see and what I experience. If there's a loud kid, I talk about it. If there's a loud adult, I talk about it. I see bad parenting all the time. And don't you fucking tell me for 1 minute that I can't know what it is because I'm not a parent or it's hard or blah, blah, blah. You don't think if I see someone smacking their kid that I don't know that's wrong and that you only know it's wrong because you're actually a parent? Let me say this. I know you think breeders are fair game. Here's the thing. I'm not thinking about people with children. You are. You think that my life as a child-free person is constantly thinking about children and people with them. It's not. I never think about it unless something like this happens, which it's been happening to me for 20 fucking years since I was old enough to be heard on stage that I don't want kids. I never thought I would have to write a book about it. By the way, that book was a bestseller, so I wasn't in my lane on that one. And it was the most popular piece of comedy I've done. Same with my first special, I'm Gonna Die Alone and I Feel Fine. I'm Gonna Die Alone is actually not about being single because I wasn't single when I wrote that special. It's about people who tell me if I don't have kids, I'll die alone. And that was so popular, they gave me another Netflix special within 2 weeks, doubled the price and said, do whatever you want. So it's actually that's what people like, because I'm giving a voice to people who are shit on by moms. There is some psychological thing that happens, I don't know what it is, where you keep claiming what I'm doing feels like an affront. I don't know you. I can't affront you. If you are offended, okay, so what you did was you felt offended by a podcast that wasn't directed at you. It literally couldn't have been because I don't know you exist. And I think therein lies the problem. That you are literally the live, laugh, love lady at her cubicle, basically calling me a rich bitch and saying that I don't understand anything. And you don't have time for this because you have kids. But you had time to write me what I think is a little bit of an unhinged email. And if this is the way you deal with strangers in the world that have not even done anything to you, I would hate to see how you teach your kids to deal and react to things. Because I used to get bullied by parents all the time on Twitter, and I would think, my God, how are they arguing that they're a good parent? What if their kids saw what they were doing? Then would you teach your kids, mommy's being affronted right now? Would you bring them into that little victimhood circle? So let me explain a few things to all of you listening who may feel how I feel, and to the sympathetic moms out there who get where I'm coming from, because I know a lot of you in real life. I don't mean the people listening to the podcast, but obviously my friends, my own mother, my family. This seems to only be a problem for strangers. The people in my life don't treat me this way. I know other people, it's different. It is the people in your life. For me, it's strangers. And what I think the issue is, I'm the one with the microphone, and somewhere deep down, you don't like that. You don't think it's fair that I get to have this glamorous life and also a microphone, and I get to comment on your life. Well, that's why I try to be really responsible with the microphone. And I don't comment on your life because, again, I literally don't know you existed. I was talking about these specific parents who let their children be pawns in a really shady group's video. a group of liberals who are trying to take down liberals. It's so specific who I was talking about that it's literally insane to me that you would take offense. Or the time I talked about the Airbnb I was in where the woman didn't list that a child running literally all the hours that you would be asleep, like 5 a.m. or 9 p.m., it didn't list it as, like, that's a big deal that you're supposed to list when you're trying to rent somewhere. And I was just wondering, again, I wonder what that kid is doing. Why does it sound so disproportionately loud? That was the conversation. Wasn't kids shouldn't run. It wasn't parents are doing anything bad. It was, this is a nightmare to have to hear. Just like anything would be, any loud person upstairs, it just, that was who it was. So let me take this apart. You just wrote me and told me how to stay in my lane. So you felt affronted by a stranger on a podcast, and then you wrote them directly to malign them, accuse them of things, and tell them what to do. You literally did what you accused me of doing. That's so unself-aware. Your kid's going to need a lot of fucking therapy. And you should get some yourself if you're not already in it. And don't tell me you don't have fucking time. That is, when I tell my mother this stuff, she can't believe how mommying has become victimhood. Yeah, it's hard. I never said it wasn't. But this notion that nothing else is as hard, that because I do things that are hard that don't have the reward, that love burst, that hormonal, that instinctive, it's worth it because of the ... joy. I have things that are just difficult, that the reverse of joy isn't there. So don't tell me about my glamorous life. So let me take this apart. You told me parenting tips from someone in your position. What's my position? Do you know anything about me? Do you know that I have, you know, vague, mild mental illness, and that for me, getting pregnant was always the biggest fear of my life because I don't know how I'd handle the hormones. And when I was a teenager, one of my jobs was babysitting for a woman who had postpartum, and I would take care of her other kid while she dealt with some really severe depression in her room and the sounds I would hear coming out of that room. And I knew in my heart that might be me someday, and I'm really afraid of this. I'm afraid that I wouldn't be able to take medication if I needed. I'm afraid of this, the hormones. I'm afraid of how I'd feel after I had the kid. I don't think this is good for me and my psyche. Would I be open to adoption if I'd ever changed my mind? Sure, I thought that too. I've mentored. I volunteer. I have a spiritual life that I don't talk about because that's sort of the part of it, is that you don't talk and brag about it. So you don't know what I do. You don't know that I mentor younger people, that I volunteer, that I've in the past taught young girls dance lessons. One young girl came to the class. She had such stage fright, she couldn't even be in the room with the mirrors. We weren't even on stage, and she would just start peeing herself. And I had to take her and help her, and I talked to her about it, and she said her mother makes her feel bad for this anxiety. And it broke my fucking heart. So what is my position exactly? A few years ago, I was writing and performing in a hit show called Chelsea Lately. A lot of people came to know me. I got to tour a little bit. I got a Netflix special. I thought, this is it. I'm really going to finally live my dream after 18 years of doing this. 15 of those, about 13 of those years unpaid. Always struggling with jobs. Some years I made $13,000 a year. And I got my Netflix special. I got to go around the world a little bit. I got another Netflix special. I got another book deal. And then the years went by and, you know, I run my own production company. I am my own corporation. I front load everything. So when I get a Netflix special, my production company pays for everything that you see, the camera, the thing. And when I go on tour, I front load things and I have to make the money back. It's a risky business. As it stands right now, I don't want to put negativity out in the universe, but it's a no from Netflix for now on another special. Sales weren't hot on some my book, so we don't know if I'll get a third book deal. I'm working on that right now. But it's like 4 months of labor without pay. Like, you have to almost practically write a book to a book pitch is like a really, you know, like a 30, 40 page document. It's a whole thing. Right now I decided to leave my job at Mrs. Maisel because it wasn't furthering my career in ways I needed it to. And I was afraid of getting stuck in a part-time job that took me out of where I live. And I couldn't really afford to live in both cities. And I was sitting in a basement in Brooklyn. It's in a warehouse. So I don't, nothing glamorous there. And I took a chance on myself this year. So this year is a whole year of self-starting. I'm going on auditions every day. I'm working on this book pitch. I could do two specials. I have so much material, but I'm going on tour and my fan base is inconsistent. I never made it big like your Ali Wong or your Chelsea Handler or your Kathy Griffin or other women or men in my peer group. I have friends that play, sell out thousands of seats the minute they go on sale. They have tour buses. They have tour managers. I don't have any of that. I do everything. I have my agent and that books and routes my tours and the, you know, like I have all the professionals on the upper levels, but when it comes to actually touring, I don't ever know how many people are coming to the show. So when I get on the plane, I don't know what my salary is going to be. On the low end, the guarantee is this. On the high end, if it sells out, it's this. People in my crowd don't tend to buy tickets until the last day. So I never know. So I'm always worried. I get up for, drive to the airport myself, park myself, take a shuttle, get up at 4 a.m., lug my own suitcases, bring my own merchandise, sell my own merchandise. You know, get up at 6 in the morning to do press. I don't know if that's helping. There's sleeplessness. And I know people with kids every day. You know, you can't fucking sleep for years. But eventually the kids grow older. So when you're 55, 60, chilling out, I'll still be touring and not sleeping. So don't tell me what my position is. I live in a rented two-bedroom apartment. It's too much of a risk if I were to buy something. It would be literally all the money I have, and I'd have $0 but a home by myself. I won an award last week, a Writers Guild Award, but it was sort of a sad event for me because, it's a job I don't work on anymore, but it's also just, it doesn't do anything for you, you know? I mean, it's a sad event, but it's not glamorous. Like, yeah, you get a dress, you get a thing. It's really cool. It's really cool to be like, wow, I was part of something. Like, I'm a hired writer. Like, I could do this. But, you know, I had a hard week last week. My friend killed himself. And I said that at the beginning of the podcast. And that you thought this would be the week to email me and tell me how terrible I am. I mean, you didn't say that. I'm being verbose. Where's the self-awareness there? Is that a good parent? Is that what you would tell your kid to do? Hey, write someone that you're offended. They just said they had a really bad week. Their friend died. They're feeling out of sorts. Write them. Tell them they don't know what they're talking about. Tell them what to do. Is that good parenting? Because the way you live in the world, if you're a parent, is parenting. That's the way I look at it. The way I live in the world as a comedian, I represent as a woman even, as a comedian, as anything. I'm always thinking of myself as like a spiritual being in the world trying to do her best. I fail a lot. So I always think, how am I representing myself in this world? So I don't care if you think how you treat your children is different than how you treat other people. It shouldn't be. The goal should not be to compartmentalize. Oh, I can treat this person that way. Because you just made me an other, which is so fucking dangerous to do as a human. You've just told me that no matter what I say, the one living my life, you've told me that it's glamorous. You could say from where I sit, it sure seems glamorous, but I believe you that it's not. Because I don't, you go, well, I didn't do it then? Because I don't do it because it's glamorous. If I did this because it was glamorous, I would have stopped doing it a long time ago. I do it because this is my gift and my calling. Whether people think I'm funny or not, it doesn't matter. I know it's my calling. I know the spiritual place I go to when I'm on stage. I know how it feels. And it's not about ego or laughs or whatever. I'm not a complete asshole who's just like a dolphin. Well, dolphins aren't assholes, but you know what I mean. I'm not a trained thing at SeaWorld. Hitting the thing, you know, a rat in a cage, hitting the dopamine hit. That's not, performing doesn't do that for me. You have to have a life outside of it or it can kill you. So I make very sure that I have a spiritual life. And it's something I do every day. I get on my knees and pray every morning before I get in the shower, like on my knees prayer. I don't even know if there's God. I'm not really praying to God. I'm humbling myself to the fact that I don't run in the universe. Is that glamorous? Is not knowing how much money I'm going to make this year glamorous to you? Is going, you know what? If I have to take a writing job, I'll cancel the rest of my tour because I can't take the fucking financial risk of touring because I just don't have a big enough fan base. Is that glamorous to you? Oh, writing jobs are glamorous. Really, is it? Is it when you've had your dream and you've kind of watched it like, I don't know what's going on this year and I think there's a message for me from the universe and I'm just going to sit like a surfer and just ride this out. I'm not sure what's happening. There's a big transition going on. I wish I had the time to just think, what's my next move? But I don't. I have to keep working through it because I have to pay the bills. Is that glamorous? But there's been a lot of disappointments in the last year. And there's been a lot of stuff that isn't disappointment that I have to get really quiet and look at and make sure that I'm not letting the disappointments narrate the story. What's going on is I'm stuck in the middle of some career stuff. And I'm going to be guided, I know, the right way for me. And it doesn't mean guided the right way that's going to bring me fame and fortune. That might not be my dharma, and it probably won't be. I think all the time about leaving what I do to do more of a life of service or something different. I don't know. You know, I don't know what I'm necessarily supposed to be doing. But the love I've been given for this stuff just seems, it would seem weird that that's not what a power greater than myself or the universe would want for me, right? Anyway, it's not glamorous. And if you keep insisting it is, then you have a really dangerous detachment from reality. So you're resentful that I have the microphone, that I get to say things about parenting that you don't. Well, how can you fix that? Why don't you do something where you get to talk about parenting? Even if it's to 5 people on a Instagram story, whatever it is. But if you're taking what I'm saying as an affront, that is entirely your issue. And this notion, you know, I mean, look, I grew up Catholic. Jesus didn't have kids. Jesus taught that you cannot judge who a teacher is going to be. The least among of us could be anything. I mean, if you ever gone to something like a 12-step meeting and you hear the story of someone who was in a gutter and now they're, you know, I mean, you it's very ignorant to think, I know you're going to come to me for parenting tips. Do I know the day-to-day of it? Of fucking course not. Of course I don't. Nobody knows what anybody literally does. I mean, other parents can share tips, and I'm sorry that these other mothers are assholes. I am aware of the phenomenon that mothers do this to each other. I have friends that are mothers. We've become this victim society where we are just children going, please hug me. Please tell me that I'm doing a good job. Please tell me it's going to be okay. Please validate for me that I'm scared. That's what you're saying to me. And that's okay to say that. But you have to learn how to say that. Maybe not to me, but just to yourself or to anyone. That's that feeling you're feeling. That's the affront. This is defensiveness. This is walls up. This is not love and light and healing. And, you know, I saw a kid on a plane and she was having a panic attack. And I knew that she was because I had panic attacks as a kid and I couldn't tell anybody because I didn't know what it was and I was afraid and I didn't want to get in trouble. My parents knew I had a fear of flying, but I didn't know I was having a panic attack. What would bring them on is on the airplanes, my ears would, you know, like feel like they were bursting from the air pressure, cabin pressure. And I didn't know my head was not going to explode. And then I would panic and there'd be crying and there'd be this. And this mother was getting really impatient with her daughter. I felt it on a deep DNA level, panic recognized panic. I said to the mother, Can I tell you something? I shared a story with her. This is how we do it in the spiritual world. We just share our story, see if it connects. If someone wants our help, great. I said, when I was little, I had really bad panic attacks on a plane. She said, no, it's her ears. I said, no, hear me out. It started with the ears. And then I developed anxiety because, you know, while parents can't fix everything, right? Like you cannot fix someone's eardrums hurting. even the attempt does something to our wiring that makes us feel safe. When we feel ignored, it fucks our wiring. And so for, I have childhood trauma. I have dysfunctional family stuff. And my family is beautiful and I'm close to them. I have my own DNA as a kid where things upset me. So don't tell me that being a kid doesn't qualify me to understand from afar some basic things about parenting. It's such bullshit. So I told, because there's a lot of, my sister teaches horseback riding. She has to undo so many of the parents' anxieties that the kids just have in their bodies. The only difference between my sister and the parents isn't just that my sister can ride a horse. It's that these kids need this relationship with her to keep developing. You don't just need parents. I said to the mother, the flight attendant, now I don't know if they do this anymore. It was post nine, you know, pre 9/11 back in the '80s. She put some wet paper towels in a microwave, got them warm, and then put one in a styrofoam cup, two styrofoam cups. I put them on either side of each ear and I held it while we were landing. I don't know why it worked. It did. And the mother just looked at me. I said, while you deal with your kid, do you want me to ask the flight attendant? So I did. I told the flight attendant the whole thing. They did it for the girl. You know, made it like 50% better, but she stopped the hysteria. Should I have not said anything because I'm not a parent? Or is it just that I can't criticize because I'm not a parent? Because again, I'm not criticizing. That's what it comes back to. This is a comedy podcast. Not funny right now. But this is a comedy podcast. I don't have a television show called Parenting Tips from the Ivory Tower. I just made some jokes on a podcast about some assholes who let their kids go into Senator Feinstein's office. My friends with kids, and you know, it's really interesting. I've always been a seeker. And I understand the concept of it's such a joy, but it's also a hell. That concept is available to me. Does that make sense? That concept of how things can be so awful and yet so amazing, unfortunately, the literal experience of parenting isn't available to me, but that concept of how could it be both is available to me in so many other ways, especially my depression and how it feels to go through the world in various times in life having clinical depression. It's not sad boohoo, she needs to cheer up. It's chemicals in the brain, or anxiety or panic disorder, or the miracle of me flying to Australia by myself, having, you know, a 12-hour panic attack the whole time, but getting through the beauty of it and relying on people. Like, I understand these moments. I understand that my parents had me. They wanted to make a child, but they didn't know who I was. They didn't know I was going to come. So I'm not mad at them for having me. In the sense that, like, you brought me into the world during climate change. I don't think that kids today are thinking that. I think even if you get born and the scientist comes on the news and he goes, wow, we have one day to live, everyone, and you're 3 years old, you're like, that's fucked up. I believe we all find the wonder and joy in our lives. There's just something unstoppable once we're here, where in a general way, we don't go, why did my parents bring me here? This is bullshit. There's war. There's blah, you know. As long as I'm here and I love being here, there's a lot to be gleaned and learned and inspired by. And then there's just pain as well, because it's life. But it's like when people trip on acid, they're like, no, you don't understand. I'm like, I actually do. I maybe didn't see what you saw, but it's possible to believe that some people among us are seekers and they're quite smart. And I have friends who have kids that I don't think they've learned some secret to life just because they have kids. I know people drink a bottle of fucking wine every night because they have a kid. You know, I know people who, before they had kids, they were weekend warrior partiers. And then they didn't have hobbies or interests. They weren't seeking. And then the kids became their number one thing. And obviously they don't drink and party. And I think to a lot of them, they forget that a lot of us never were doing that in the first place. I was always 24/7 dedicated to getting this fucking weird career going because I didn't know how to do it. I had to spend so much time figuring it out. I had to end relationships because people wanted kids and I didn't. It was sad. It was such a, you know, this decision, which isn't even a decision against, like, I just don't want to, has definitely brought hardship to my life. But there's joy to it as well. and the joy outweighs the hardship. But these parents I know, I remember going to their house one night and leaving at 9 after we had, like, you know, I played with their kid for a few hours before dinner. Then we had dinner. I was exhausted. And I was driving home at 9 because I like to be in bed at 10, like in bed about to fall asleep at 10. And they said, "Where are you going now? Another party?" I was like, "I'm 43 years old. What other party is there?" I wouldn't go to a party on the same night that I hung out with them. You know what I mean? It's like one or the other. But I don't know what party this would be. And I said, no. So there's this notion that no one can fathom what we're doing with all of our free time, but we don't have free time either. And there's this notion, well, but you could, you don't have to do everything you're doing. It's not like it's a living, breathing thing that will die. I'm the only one taking care of me. I don't have family money. And I don't have a partner. So it is a living, breathing thing that will die. It's just sort of the corner I painted myself into with this life, you know? And it's fine. I love my life. I have an abundance of beautiful friends, people that live near me. I have a gorgeous career, even though I'm really confused what's going on with it right now. It seems to be in a slump. I'm not sure. But I've got a great fan base who does come out to support me. I love what I do. I love stupid shit. I love my clothes. I like my looks. I like, I do like my place. I like everything. I love traveling. I just wake up and I'm like, I'm full of love. And I'm also a curmudgeonly person with like chemical issues sometimes, you know, chemical depression. But that's not how, I move through the world with wonder. And I don't think it's fair to use someone's email address to tell them all of the things you think they're doing wrong and to project onto them and to insist to them that their life is glamorous. I mean, yes, I have two sequined pillows. I get where you see that I might be glamorous. So for the mothers out there, I'm sorry if anything I'm ever saying comes off as parenting advice or, oh, it's so easy. It's not easy. As you notice, I'm not fucking doing it. But it's because I find my life already to be difficult enough. Not because I can't stop partying or being glamorous. Who has time for a kid? It's the opposite. It's that it would be the end of me if I had a kid. Because I can't handle all the stuff I have to handle and a kid. And the good news is I don't desire a kid, so I'm not sad about this. It never once was shit. I have things in my life that I feel that dichotomy about where I'm like, I want to do it, but I can't. That tortures me. I don't have that with kids. Thank God. I did the right thing for me. But again, it's not because my life is a never-ending party and I couldn't be bothered to change a diaper. And please don't treat other people this way if you're in charge of a child. Somehow this nasty attitude of treating people this way will get into your kid. And I know I am giving I'm giving unsolicited parenting advice, but I cannot help it. I am talked to this way by so many people with kids that it frightens me. It makes me sad for the kid. Anyway. That's what I had to say about this. Again, I really hope that I don't have to take down the email because I check my own email and I know people volunteer to do it. It's not going to work out for me. I would like to just be able to know that people are using it to discuss things we talk about on the podcast and not come after me like that. You're writing to a human being and you never know what's been going on with them when you treat someone like that. And you really took me down for the day. I was completely powerless over how upset I was. And I did all my self-care stuff. I had to do extra stuff to kind of just calm down that day because of that. So you definitely changed my energy that day. Is that good parenting? I don't know. I think a lot more of us need therapy. If anyone feels like they need therapy after hearing me be so upset, well, good. So we got my favorite sponsor, Talkspace. TALKSPACE.com. Talk is in talking, space is in, you got room to do it. Talkspace.com. Go to Talkspace.com, and if you use code Jen, you're going to get $45 off your first month. So what is it? Well, it's an online therapy company that makes taking care of your mental health more affordable and convenient than ever before. You just provide your preferences for therapy. Talkspace matches you with one of 3,000 plus therapists the very same day. You can send unlimited text, audio, picture, or video messages anywhere, anytime. You're going to hear back daily, 5 days a week. You just need a computer with an internet connection or the Talkspace mobile app. Listen, no matter what you're going through, you are not alone. Join more than 1 million people who are feeling happier with Talkspace. You don't need to visit multiple therapists in order to find the right one. This whole app has a unique matching process, and it takes preferences into account, and you're going to find someone whose style and expertise matches what you need. Talk about anything, family issues, work issues, stuff you've always wanted to figure out. And you can switch therapists at any time for no extra cost. Taking care of your mental health shouldn't be more work. That's why Talkspace is great. There's no commutes. There's no insurance. It's not overpriced. In fact, Talkspace, 1 month on the Talkspace platform costs about the same as a single face-to-face session. And you don't have to wait a week to share what's on your mind. Again, send your therapist unlimited text, audio, picture, or video messages. They have over 3,000 licensed therapists who are experienced in addressing the challenges we all face. To match with your perfect therapist for a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, go to Talkspace.com and make sure to use code Jen. You're going to get $45 off your first month. And introducing Talkspace Teens. 1 in 5 children deals with a mental health issue in their lives. And that's why Talkspace now offers counseling to teenagers ages 13 and up. They can message a licensed counselor from their phone or computer anywhere, anytime. No extra appointments for you, scheduling things, missing classes. Nope, not with Talkspace for Teens. You can help take care of your child's well-being with the help of a professional in an easy and private way. Let's talk about third love, baby. Let's talk. Okay. What if they were like, oh my God, that was the greatest theme song. Let's do it. Third love. Go to thirdlove.com/fun right now to find your perfect fitting bra, and you're going to get 15% off your first purchase. That's right. These bras have the perfect fit. Millions of real women's measurements have been taken into account in designing their bras with breast size and shape in mind for an impeccable fit and feel. It's the industry leader. There are 70 sizes. There's 70 kinds of titties out there, including their signature half a cup sizes. Convenience, find your fit in 60 seconds with their online fit finder. People, I have done this, it's easy. Order and try on at home. And they make other things as well. I have an amazing Third Love cotton bathrobe. I swear to God, I'm wearing it right now. It's made with Pima, incredibly premium, smooth cotton. Breathable, you'll want to wear their underwear every day. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now they are offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/fun right now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. thirdlove.com/fun for 15% off today. Tagless labels, no itching, straps that won't slip, ultra soft smoothing fabrics, lightweight, super thin memory foam cups, 100% fit guarantee. Their team of expert fit stylists, again, are helping you find your perfect fit. And they have recently launched a new cotton collection with cotton t-shirt bras and cotton underwear. I'm super into Third Love, you guys. And yeah, and they have really cool bathrobes too. So get on it. Thirdlove.com/fun. I was going to read something that I wrote. Would that be a nice palate cleanser? It's going to take a while to read, though. I'll just tell you some funny stories. I got on the phone with my mom. Jennifer Luke Perry had a stroke. I said, oh my God, I didn't know that. That's so terrible. Because I had just been reading that there was going to be a 90210 reunion. And she said, well, he wasn't going to be in it anyway, which I didn't know this. She said, well, your father, he never gets anything right. But he did break the news. He was upstairs on the computer and he yelled down, Joanne, someone from Hollywood had a stroke. He has a little bit of a beard. And I said, you figured out from that it was Luke Perry? And she said, no, I went up and looked. Like, I don't know what it is. Like, so my dad reads someone has a stroke. The name is obviously there. Like, if he has the information that the dude has a stroke, has had a stroke, and he sees the picture, I don't know why he, like, can't connect saying the name. Joanne, someone from Hollywood. Emergency. So my mom is seeing Joan Jett. Eddie Money is opening for Joan Jett. Now, I don't really know a lot about Eddie Money. Maybe he's cooler than I think. But I always get upset when I think performers are being paired up with the wrong people. But I'm sure Joan is knows what she's fucking doing. And again, I bet Eddie Money is cooler than I think. And I'm sure if you guys have any Eddie Money information, you can tweet at me. At I Seem Fun Podcast on Twitter. You can bring it up in the Facebook group. If you go to facebook.com/I Seem Fun Podcast, you can find out how to request to join the group or go to the Twitter account. And there's a link there. Or send me an email, iseemfun@gmail.com, and tell me what I don't realize about Eddie Money's coolness. I don't even know one of his songs. Eddie Money hit song. So anyway, so my mom's going to see it. She goes, I was like, I know. I looked up Joan Jett. I said, oh my God, I love Joan Jett. That's right. Two tickets to paradise. Oh, that song? I don't think Eddie Money should. I don't think he's up to snuff with Joan Jett, who's a legend. I mean, like she's a groundbreaker. If you guys haven't seen that documentary, Bad Reputation, Joan Jett is a beautiful human who does so many good things for other people. And she really, really inspired me. I think I might watch this documentary again. And if you really don't think sexism is a thing, you got to see it. It's wonderful. And her relationship with her manager is incredible. It's just absolutely adorable. Is this two tickets to paradise? Ugh, such a cheese ball. Oh my God, in 1987... he looked old. I don't know. I mean, maybe people will be into it. If Joan thinks it's cool, I think it's cool. So I'm going to see Joan Jett. Oh, I'm excited. And I said, oh, I wish I could go. Because, you know, my mom is seeing it at Foxwoods Casino. And I said, well, maybe will you see her when she comes through LA? And then I just think of, like, you know, my parents are at the casino, right? So they've already driven there. They've parked. You know, they're there for the weekend. So they come down from their hotel room. They walk into the theater. It's so different. Anyone else who knows that, you know, you live anywhere. You're driving into the city. And you're just like, oh, so it's an hour traffic there. And for me, like, I live near the Hollywood Bowl. I mean, it doesn't matter if I take an Uber or I drive myself. Once you get near it, you're stuck in traffic for an hour to go 5 feet. So you have to park like a mile away 4 hours before said event and then just walk. It's like, it's a whole thing. It's just, not everything is at the Hollywood Bowl, but anywhere is a pain in the ass, in my humble opinion, except there's like a couple theaters. There was this one night where The Cure and Morrissey were across the street from each other at these Hollywood theaters. And I bought a ticket to both. The Cure played a 3-hour concert. They were playing these three albums. And one of the albums I don't love. So I left during that album. And I went to see Morrissey for an hour. It was like the night of my life. I couldn't believe it. I kept telling 15-year-old Jen, you get to do this when you're a grown-up. She was like, I don't even care. Because I'm 15-year-old Jen. And I hate you because you're a grown-up. So anywho, I just said, and she goes, well, we have different lifestyles. Like my 80-year-old mother, like, listen, you can't see Joan Jett like I can because you're not up for it in the same way that I am. And she's right. She has a second wind that I haven't had yet. Because I'm so tired leading my glamorous life. Sorry. And by the way, if I had a glamorous life, I would be unashamed of it. My life as a performer is no more of value because it's, you know, a little bit working class. I long for a life of luxury and glamour. It's all I want. It's all I fucking want up in here. So, Jen, do you think that the people who have a life of luxury and glamour don't tell off their fans? They probably don't. But I gotta be me. Anyway, so that's that. Talk to my mom. I don't even know. Talked to her about many things. She was just cracking me up, but I can't remember what it was now. I'm going up to the, I have an hour free, so I'm going to go up to the computer to listen to your latest podcast. I'm like, oh, mom, you're stuck in another time. You don't have to listen to podcasts that way, stuck at the dial-up computer or the plug-in computer. Well, I do things my way. All right. She listens to it like it's an old radio show. Ow. Getting a lot of compliments about last week's Roger Stone trial. And by compliments, I mean one from my sister. Should I do the Michael? I loved Michael Cohen trial. You know, because I'm a hippie dips, I'm like, oh my God, I feel bad for him. But he's only sorry because he got caught. I do think what I loved though was when they were like, liar, liar, pants on fire. And he goes, the way you're behaving, basically the Republicans would not ask him any questions. Because, you know, although Michael Cohen is shady and they were trying to talk to him about his own taxes and his own missteps in life, he's a fixer for Donald Trump, right? He lied for Trump for more than a decade. So if they ask him about doing that, then in effect they're going to be admitting that they're interested in if Trump's a liar, and that for some reason this GOP is not breaking from ranks with the president. So they didn't ask him any questions. The hearing is supposed to be for them to learn more info about the president and what he did and what he's doing. The Democrats were asking those kind of questions. Republicans were going, you lie. And so one guy made a sign that said, liar, liar, pants on fire. So they were saying, why would we believe anything you're saying now, since you've always been a liar and a fixer? Now, it's not a bad question. I'm sure he's not being totally truthful about some Russia stuff. Who knows what's going on still? You know, I don't know. But in general, it's not unheard of that somebody flips. If you've seen a movie, it's happened. Watch The Godfather. Watch Goodfellas. These are things that happen. People in the mob flip. So while their logic, I get it's the one thing they could throw out there. How do we believe you now? It's like, because this is a thing that happens. If he was lying now as well, the stories would contradict each other and there's still a truth in there somewhere. So anyway, this one Republican had a sign that said, liar, liar, pants on fire. Michael Cohen basically said, the way you guys are behaving, I invented that. This gaslighting, this silliness. I created this with Trump. I'm done now. And you guys are still doing it. He said it way better, but it was my favorite part. But I'm interested to see what happens to him. I mean, I don't know. I mean, he's all up in this. I mean, I think he was doing, not just covering what Trump was doing. I believe he was solidly handing voter data to his going to Prague. I believe he was paying Russia for the hacking and the trolls. I mean, this dude fucked us up for a good long time. And it was amazing how charming, and he wasn't that guy. You know, he was some other version of himself. So obviously a terrible, shady person. We get this. I ain't a ding dong ding do. But there is something Christmas movie. Somebody is trying to find redemption that I always go, meh. And I shouldn't. And I know it's really hard to talk about, like, I'm just a really good person who's really into redemption after saying that horrible thing to that mother. Now, look, I'll admit that email really touched me off because it's how I've been being spoken to by parents for 20 years. And it's painful. And you assuming that not having kids was just a breeze to live through, that it didn't cost me relationships with certain men, that it didn't make me an outcast among some of my friends, that it didn't feel weird or different or incomplete at times, that it wasn't just easy, but that it was ultimately what I really wanted, and I have no regrets. But if you think it's that black and white, then I don't know where you learn to be a human, but I hope to God you get to have some more time for self-development, because you deserve more than how you look at life right now and how you look at other people. And I'm sorry for saying any mean words that just weren't aiding in any kind of intellectual human discourse, but I'm also angry. And I wanted to let people know that you do affect someone when you write to them and tell them how to run their life, and when you tell them what you believe their life is, despite me telling you what it is, you're saying, I don't believe you. It's really sucky. And again, I don't know, a lot of people do not grasp the difference between me talking into this microphone right now, not having a clue who hears this, and you guys writing me directly and telling me what you think of me. How you don't see that one is personal and one is not, if it's not clear, I don't know, ask someone else. Anyway, so the other night at my storytelling show, I read an essay that I wrote, and, you know, listen, let me just put it this way. It's very white person perspective. It's half informative, but it's entertainment. It's performance. It's entertainment. It's fun. This isn't, I'm not reading an encyclopedia to you. So you might, please don't get upset. But it's a funny essay. And I say funny, not being like, oh, you're going to laugh your ass off. But it's a comedic, you know, light in tone essay, although a little dark, about letting Generation X guide you into the end of the world. And so I thought I would read it to you, because it might be a fun way to end the podcast. And I usually read articles, so why not read something that I wrote? So this is my love letter to Millennial and to Gen X, asking the Millennials permission to let us help guide you through to the end of the world. Here we go. By Jen Kirkman. I was checking Twitter to see if anyone agreed with my tweet that the movie Reality Bites still holds up, when I saw a strange comment in my mentions. You out-of-touch old people need to die off. Under that comment, a different one from a different person. You all went to college for free, so you got yours, and now you don't care about us. And the tweet that upset me enough that made me climb into bed before it got dark. Your generation is why we have climate change. You were all slackers who didn't care. I'd just come back from a special 25-year anniversary matinee of Reality Bites with Liz, my old college roommate. Liz is the person I originally saw Reality Bites with 25 years ago in 1994. The girls sitting behind us in the movie theater weren't alive when Liz and I first saw Reality Bites. The scene when Winona dialed a psychic 1-800 number from her landline, they said, oh my God, in the same way that I said those words when I stood on 6th Avenue and watched the Twin Towers fall on 9/11. When Ben Stiller's character used a payphone, one of them whispered, why though? Half the audience wasn't alive in the 90s, and the other half were Gen Xers, people who haven't lived since the 90s. Young people's curiosity at how Generation X used to live and the Gen Xers' nostalgia for how we used to live made for the perfect vibe for a couple of hours while we all ignored today's biting reality. From under my covers, I refreshed my Twitter. A lot of people who were young enough to be my children were pissed at me. I was called apathetic, cynical, a loser, and brainwashed by MTV. It was like being back in the 1990s and reading an op-ed written by a baby boomer. How could these kids hate me? Didn't they understand that we were them first? After Kurt Cobain died, Courtney Love went into the neighborhood park and tried to console an entire generation of kids who were wandering around in shock and in flannel. There's a YouTube video of this. She said to them, "He doesn't want to be known for being a loser or anything that Rush Limbaugh called him. These baby boomers aren't supposed to understand. People over 32 aren't meant to understand. These people grew up in the 60s in the generation gap, and now they're really pissed that there's another one because they don't want to grow old." Am I now one of the over 32, fuck, over 42 even, who suddenly doesn't understand and doesn't want to grow old? I blame Urban Outfitters for the fact that I blindly thought that everyone loved my generation. When I'm nostalgic, which is every 5 minutes because I'm Gen X, I pop into Urban Outfitters to look at the Nirvana t-shirts, cardigan grandpa sweaters, instant film cameras, and Pearl Jam on vinyl. I don't even like Pearl Jam. I was never into them, but it's satisfying that someone walking into that store to buy current music can't. Being inside of an Urban Outfitters gives me that warm, safe feeling that I imagine seeing that my old bedroom wasn't turned into a guest room, but has remained a shrine to me in my time period, a thing that didn't happen. I observe people who could be my teenage kid shopping at Urban, so I assumed in a general way that they approved of my generation and me. When I was 12 years old, before grunge came around, I went through a hippie phase. I idolized the fashions from the 1960s and went vintage shopping for anything wide-legged or polyester with flowers. Everyone always looked so effortlessly chic. I just didn't want to dress like these hippies. I idealized their values, too. Peace, love, no war, freedom. I wondered, where had the values of these hippies gone? It sucked being a kid in the selfish, greedy Reagan 1980s. My school was full of rich assholes. I didn't find out until later that the hippies had become the parents of the assholes who I hated. They were now yuppies. They were the ones making things shitty. They sold out and brought kids into the shitty world that they gave up on. And now the cycle continues with the millennial shopper at Urban Outfitters in me. They respect my Warren and Ramones t-shirt, but they don't respect me. I'm the establishment. I have failed their generation, but I refuse to accept this. If only all of them could watch Reality Bites, they'd realize that feeling helpless and being in college debt was invented by Gen X. One dude on Twitter told me that I couldn't relate to him because I don't have student loans. He's right. I don't have student loans. I had student loans, but I paid them off. Not because I'm rich, but because I'm in perimenopause and it's been 23 years since I got saddled with them. I know the 90s seem like the dark ages with what you've heard of our cassette tapes and our cigarettes made from tobacco and not vapor, but the 1990s aren't the 1890s. We didn't stop by the schoolhouse in the town square to read the shared encyclopedia that rests next to a sign reading, "Take a page, leave a penny." Generation X is so misunderstood. The past is just one big blob to a young person. I really want us to be heard before we're just a memory. And more than that, I want to help younger people because I think they may be going about it wrong. And by it, I mean everything. This isn't a holier-than-thou kids today critique. This is a plea to the young to let Generation X guide you through the end of the world as we know it. I'll break it down how we can be your guide in three parts. History, in order to gain your trust. You have to know our story, where we come from. Reality, I'll have to tell you what your parents didn't about what's going on. Spirituality. Generation X are natural Buddhists. Whether we embrace that or not, it's there. And it's how we survive. Let's begin. History. We were raised not just by baby boomers, but lots of us were children of parents from the silent generation, those born between 1925 and 1945. They worked jobs that now might be inappropriate for children, and they kept quiet. Children were to be seen and not heard. In 1951, a Time magazine article was written, and it described that generation of children as unimaginative, withdrawn, unadventurous, and cautious. My parents are silent generation, so even in my riot girl feminist years where I was singing Bikini Kill at the top of my lungs, "I'm so sorry if I'm alienating some of you, your whole fucking culture alienates me," I was fearless about it, not because I was brave, but because I already felt defeated. No one's listening anyway. Teenagers raised by the silent generation and college radio became a conflicted combination of badass Lucy with equal I just can't win Charlie Brown. My parents didn't even think that they could possibly have any wisdom to impart to me. They taught me how to do laundry, write checks, grocery shop, and drive. That's about it. And driving, barely. They hysterically screamed, "You're gonna crash!" as I, nowhere near crashing, learned to make left turns in an empty high school parking lot. My parents simply kept me alive, and I pieced together a sense of myself from punk rock mixtapes from my older neighbor and my subscription to Sassy magazine. Generation X wasn't told that we could do or be anything we wanted because our parents didn't want to lie to us. Our parents couldn't have set us up for the future because we were the first generation to go from analog to digital. We've been to the bottom and back professionally several times, from the first dot-com bubble bursting, I've worked at three of them and got laid off every time, to 9/11, to the 2008 recession. We keep surviving. Very few Gen Xers believe in the American dream, according to Pew Research, compared to almost 70% of millennials and baby boomers who still do. Generation X people born between 1965 and 80, the middle child generation, caught between boomers and younger millennials. We are neglected and ignored, but according to Forbes, we have found our way to positions of power, but of course it's very under the radar. We're mentoring younger coworkers, but we're not broadcasting it, and no, that's not because we don't know how to use Snapchat. In fact, Generation X are the people who are on the internet the most. I think it's because we're still excited that we can play music on our typewriters now. It was once the American way that one generation would do better financially than the previous one, but Gen X put a stop to that. We have less wealth than our parents did at our age, partly due to lingering college debts and having to take care of our boomer parents and our returning home millennial kids. In other words, we're surrounded by deadbeats, and they're the ones calling us slackers. We were not ignorant about climate change. I read a book about deforestation when I was 13. It warned that if we don't stop the meat industry, and especially the fast food industry, which tears down rainforests to raise cattle, we would see catastrophic, past the point of no return, changes to the climate in 30 years. I immediately became a vegetarian, which was July 3rd. Perfect. I could do my part to save the planet and be a self-righteous barbecue guest walking around eating mustard on a bun. I witnessed the advent of the 24-hour cable news cycle with the CNN. I watched the Iraq war in real time on television. "Jennifer, the war is on," my dad would call to me. CNN reporter Walter Rogers, who was embedded with the U.S. Army 7th Cavalry in Iraq, and cameraman Charles Miller provided some of the first real-time images from the battlefield. Quote, "These are live pictures of the 7th Cavalry racing across the deserts in southern Iraq," Rogers announced. "What you're watching here is truly historic television and journalism." CNN viewers in the United States and around the world actually knew about the attack on Baghdad before any of the soldiers here in the field, Rogers said. "I watched, terrified, wondering what was happening to my world that seemed to be changing so fast." Media critics predicted that having the war in our living room didn't necessarily help people feel more empathy, but could have done the opposite. Former Marine and author Anthony Swofford wrote in a New York Times Magazine essay that people adopted the detached attitude of, "Oh, war can't be that bad if they let us watch it." I wasn't one of those people. I started wearing two watches on my wrist at school as a protest, one set to Eastern Standard Time and another to Baghdad time. I did this because I was saddened about the stupidity of war and also to seem interesting. My generation saw Anita Hill be dragged because a Supreme Court justice had harassed her. I fought with the principal of my high school for my gay best friend to have the right to take his boyfriend to the prom. We lost, and he had to go to the prom with me. I co-founded a recycling club at my high school. I did so because I cared about the environment and because I had a crush on Jeremy, the other founder. The teachers were not on our side. They didn't want extra unsightly trash cans in their classrooms. Jeremy and I snuck around the classrooms after school to dig paper out of the trash and then put it in another bin that probably went somewhere and never got recycled, but my hand did meet Jeremy's a few times in those trash cans, which made the whole thing worthwhile. I'm trying to illustrate that I had the right ideas, but I had no power. I had information that I felt the whole world needed to know. I wanted to reach more people than the dozens or so I already knew in real life. I even tried calling the local news to see if they would do a story about how our local McDonald's was contributing to a thing that would kill us all. They hung up on me. But as my mom weirdly, psychically, almost like she was foreseeing Facebook Live, said to me, "Unless you find a way to broadcast your message from your bedroom to the world, this is it. You can't reach everyone." I was despondent. I was listening to Morrissey, wearing all black, and sitting and writing poems in my bedroom. I was the new silent generation. I had no power except the power to start a punk band with my friends. You bet I wrote an angry song about the men of the Supreme Court and another one about the bassist in the band who I was having an affair with behind my friend's back, but that's not relevant. I marched to keep abortion safe and legal. You just have no idea because I didn't have Instagram, so I can't prove it. Cameras were expensive and heavy. Wearing a 35mm camera was like slinging a brick around our necks. And disposable cameras were expensive for broke college students. And what if the photos didn't come out right? We couldn't check them. And I won't chastise an entire generation for having an $800 phone in their pocket. But seriously, gang, I just told you we couldn't afford a cardboard camera. And you're telling me that I had it easy? I know, that's not fair of me. Times are different. You need the phone to practically do anything today, trust me. I use a talking map to tell me how to drive places that I already know how to get to. But the talking points you guys are using against us, man, just like Urban Outfitters are recycled styles from Gen Xers, your insults for us are recycled baby boomer talking points. When people told Gen Xer Kurt Cobain that he was the voice of a generation, he snarled and was like, eh, he didn't want that crown. When people told Lena Dunham that she was the voice of her generation, she said, I know. My generation doesn't want any expectations put on us. We were trying to not think like the adults. We weren't slacking on social justice. We were slacking on ruthless greed and ambition. Of course, the baby boomers thought we weren't doing anything. It's because we weren't aspiring to be part of their clubs. We were slacking on their ambition for us, not our own. Gen X agrees with millennials about what's wrong with the world. We know and agree on what needs to be done to try to change all of the bad things in our world. But after some contemplation, I've realized that the difference between these two generations, Xers believe ultimately that we can't change all of the bad things in our world. Maybe it's because no one ever took us seriously. We just trudged on doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do, but we had to get out of result or we were going to drive ourselves insane. It's not cynicism, it's optimism with a healthy dose of realism. It's just like Winona Ryder and Ethan Hawke discussed in the kitchen before they had sex during the defining scene in Reality Bites. She says, I just don't know why things can't go back to normal at the end of the half hour like on Brady Bunch or something. And he whispers seductively, because Mr. Brady died of AIDS. So now that you see a little bit of where I'm coming from, let's settle in for a reality check. I know not all Gen X are cool. Look at Ted Cruz. Statistically, Gen X aren't great parents. We're known to put more effort into our partnership, and a lot of Gen X people have fallen for those anti-vaccine arguments. Every generation has their assholes, right? We have Jenny McCarthy, and you have everyone involved in the Fire Festival. I understand that you may hate us because your parents are us. Why would you listen to anyone who's as old as your mom? But that's what aunts are for, to have someone your mom's age that wears better jeans and has had enough free time to gain real-world perspective in ways people who are too busy being parents can't. I know every parent thinks, not me, I'm the cool parent. Yeah, keep thinking that. And keep thinking that your eight-year-old son has never seen porn. So real talk, that climate change thing that my generation didn't start, it's bad. It's like there's no hope. We're past the tipping point. Glaciers are breaking off. Polar bears are heading into cities to stick their heads into your freezers bad. I might just start smoking again because it's pretty much guaranteed that I won't live long enough for it to kill me. I have more of a chance of dying in a tsunami, a mudslide, a raging forest fire, a hurricane in a place that's never had hurricanes. That's another thing that sucks for your generation. Baby boomers smoked their whole lives, and then when their kids started smoking, they told us it was bad for us, and then they banned smoking in every indoor place. Cars don't have built-in lighters or ashtrays anymore. There's just an empty cubbyhole where the fun used to be. And don't try to tell me that a USB port is fun. Young people are always being made fun of for being on their phones. Well, since you can't smoke, what else are you going to do with your hands? How else are you going to distract yourself from your own thoughts? That's what smoking used to do for Gen X. That's what we did in a restaurant after we placed our order and before the food came. We smoked. We didn't talk. We blew smoke at each other and ashed in the breadbasket. Phones, smoking, these are all things that we pull out to relieve the undercurrent of our anxiety with quick hits of serotonin. Being young is anxiety-producing, and that goes against every lie that you are told about what it is to be young. We're told it's the best time of our lives, and if it's not the best time of our lives, who do we complain to? The people chastising us that we're wrong about our own feelings, about our own life? In your 20s, even though you're an adult, That's only technically. You have all of your pubic hair, congrats, and you may even have had a pregnancy scare, but you're not fully developed. You haven't been an adult for even a decade. Most of your adult life has been developmental stages, childhood, teen years. Your reactions to your feelings and stress run high. Maybe it's why younger people party more and yell woo for no reason. You don't have me fooled. I know behind every woo there's a why. Famous Generation Xer who wrote the novel Generation X, Douglas Copeland, said in an interview recently that he feels neutral about millennials. He says, I will say that pretty much everything they say about millennials is what they said about Gen X, except that millennials seem unable to cope when things don't go their way. Well, when it comes to sitting with the feelings of how hard it is to be in the world, you have very little experience, and us middle-aged people have slight amnesia. We are starting to forget how hard it can be to be younger, and I'm so grateful for that. When I remember a night in 1997, I woke up, I caught my boyfriend cheating. I went home to my own bed in my shitty Quincy, Massachusetts apartment and woke up with a cockroach on my nose and a rat in my microwave. When I look back on that memory, I see it as a photo. I have no idea how I felt. It makes me laugh. I doubt I was laughing then, but now it's kind of funny. How did a rat even get in the microwave? He was determined. The entire back of the microwave was loose, like he had a screwdriver and a couple out-of-work electrician buddies to help him. Your generation may have free access to meditation apps, and you can tweet about depression without feeling too stigmatized, and that's why you're going to be great parents, again, if the world doesn't end. But you were parented by parents who still had to sweep anxiety under the rug because of their parents. I went on Prozac when I was 22. I didn't tell anyone. To be on antidepressants in the 90s was more controversial than being on heroin. I was too afraid to ask if I could go to therapy as a teenager because I was afraid that my parents would throw me in a mental institution. I only knew what therapy was from watching Annie Hall, and even then I thought it was only for adults in New York City. You're handling anxiety with coping skills learned by people who were parented by people who didn't cope at all. The acceptance of depression and anxiety as normal don't magically undo years of your upbringing and wiring. It's overwhelming to be an adult, and it takes practice. In your 20s, there's still a certain immaturity. Feelings feel like facts, and there's still a necessary narcissism in your psyche that's left over from child development. You ever wonder why toddlers don't ask how we are, even though we're wiping their asses? Narcissism. Renowned psychoanalyst Heinz Kohut believed that narcissism was a rite of passage in child development. Having a grandiose self eventually blossoms into healthy self-esteem. Don't fall victim to believing, though, that you are the only person who has ever felt how you feel, and that the older people who made you certainly can't pull you out of this. It's not entirely true. We're learning at the same time that you guys are, and we might not be able to pull you out of anything, but we can walk you through it if you believe us. There's no nailed it mountain that you can reach the summit where you finally realize that you know it all. You never will. Never, ever. You'll have a sense of humor about what you lack and what you fear as you get older. When things in your body start breaking down, you know, for me, it's that neck arthritis and that perimenopause. I'm always sweating and I can't turn my head. How am I at this phase when I still have more to accomplish and learn and redeem and fix and enjoy? But now I can pull from decades of my own life experience as an adult. So if there isn't an adult around, I can talk to myself. What do you think, Jen? Remember the time you did that thing and then made that choice and it felt like this? Do you want to do that again? No, that was awful. Okay, well, don't do that again then. Do anything but that. Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll do that. Thanks, Jen. You always have the best advice. Hey, I'm no smarter than you, Jen. I've just been you for so long that I sort of know what works for you and what doesn't. Thanks, Jen. If you start trying to change the way you see things now, you'll only get more flexible with age. Mentally, not physically, trust me. My Pilates teacher thought I was hungover one morning when really I was just 44 at 8 a.m. The intensity with which you feel stuff can change. You don't even have to change your circumstances first. You will be, for the most part, okay. And if you're ready, it's time for your spiritual awakening. There are a lot of songs about dancing and partying. My parents had Chubby Checker telling them to do the twist. Just do the twist. Those are the lyrics. Over and over. Just do the twist. It goes like this. Younger people have turned down for what? Fire up another round of shots. Turn down for what? Those are the lyrics. When I was a kid, I had Prince telling me about dancing and partying like it was 1999. His lyrics were, "Everybody's got a bomb. We could all die any day. But life is just a party and parties weren't meant to last. War is all around us. My mind says prepare to fight." We weren't dancing and twisting and turning down for what because things were good. We were dancing because psychos ran the world and we were running out of time. You guys didn't have the proper music for the end of the world. And when I was a teenager, I got to dance to It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. That very accidentally Buddhist perspective that both Prince and Michael Stipe sang from, whether they knew it or not, was ingrained in the soul of the Gen X kid. We were properly warned with a catchy beat that shit was fucked up, but there was still room for joy. I don't know why Kurt Cobain named his band Nirvana, but to me it's perfect proof that my generation is a little bit enlightened. The definition of Nirvana is not happiness. It's complete freedom from attachment. It means in Sanskrit to blow out. It means to extinguish not only pain and worry, but also desire and all personal wishes. If it is happiness, it's not one that we can comprehend. It doesn't mean fun and turn down for what. It just means nothing. Mr. Rogers taught us that we are special because we exist. We are not special because we're actually special. We're all not special in our own non-special ways. Isn't that a relief? It doesn't mean that we get to be lazy. It just means that we don't have to worry about being perfect. It's why it's good to not get a trophy just for participating. We are allowed to fail because we're still worthy when we do. We know we aren't unique. The human condition is not unique. Thank God, or we would be so lonely. The three big tent items in Buddhism are, and forgive my pronunciation, everyone, dukkha, samudaya, and nirodha. Dukkha means suffering exists. Life is suffering. Suffering is real and almost universal. Suffering has many causes: loss, sickness, pain, failure, and the impermanence of pleasure. It's like Beck told us, "I'm a loser baby, so why didn't you kill me?" Samudaya, there's a cause of suffering. Suffering is due to attachment. It's the desire to have and control things. It can take many forms: the desire for fame, the desire to avoid unpleasant sensations like fear, anger, or jealousy. It's like Courtney Love sang in her song Violet: "When they get what they want and they never want it again, go on, take everything I want you to. Go on, take everything I dare you to." Nirodha, there is an end to suffering. Attachment can be overcome. Suffering ceases with the final liberation of nirvana. The mind experiences complete freedom, liberation, and non-attachment. It lets go of any desire or craving. Just like Alanis Morissette told us, "The moment I let go of it was the moment I got more than I could handle. The moment I jumped off of it was the moment I touched down." So what if you took care of yourself as well as the world? What if you did the right thing because it was the right thing to do? And not because you think you might actually change the world or that you have to. What if you took the anxiety that I had as a kid, that everyone has to know what I know, it's not enough that I'm only reaching a few people at a time, and just threw that away? What if helping others around you felt as significant as getting 10,000 retweets on your opinions on the NRA? Here's a thought you may find dark, but then again, you didn't dance to a song about Armageddon as a preteen. But would you actually be happier if everything was how you wanted it? Would you be able to learn anything if you could bend the world to what you think is right? What if you stopped fighting the universe and the natural flow of things? What if you surrender to the complete acceptance of what is, even if you hate what is? What if you took action from that place of surrender instead of a place of control? Einstein said that the most important decision we make is whether we believe we live in a friendly or hostile universe. What if you live in a friendly universe at the same time that you live on a dying planet? What if it all isn't ours for saving? What if it was never meant to end up okay, and that this is part of the human journey? What if it's not up to you to decide what's okay? What if, as Rumi said, we are all just walking each other home? What if we all just started smoking again? Until next week, have fun.